Welcome to Ouroboros Podcast, episode number 184. I'm your host, Colin, coming to you from Bath. And I'm back on my regular schedule this week after the Podcrawl episode. Basically means I haven't done this for over 2 weeks now. So, got some stuff stored up. Got a scandal to talk about, I guess you'd say, which I haven't had a chance to address on this podcast because of the delay due to the Podcrawl, but I think it's interesting, worth talking about. And I've also got 2 episodes of Doctor Who stored up to talk about. And as a happy coincidence, it's actually a two-parter, so I can get both parts of the two-parter out of the way in this episode. So yeah, a bit of catching up to do this week. Oh, and speaking of which, the Giro d'Italia was won by Alberto Contador at a canter. He is far and away the best stage race rider of this generation. And I think he would be, even without the alleged clenbuterol use. But he did win it at a canter, and on 2 separate occasions he let somebody else win the stage. One of whom was a former teammate of his. So, yeah, it was actually rather dull in a sporting sense, but obviously the death of Wouter Weylands makes it a bit more historic in a wider context, I guess. And yeah, we had another active cycle rider die a couple of weeks ago, Javier Tondo, who rode for the Movistar team, was going out for a training ride in his home in Spain and got trapped between his car and the automatic garage doors, which is a bizarre way to go. And rather tragic. So yeah, 2 active riders dying within, 2 weeks of each other. Rather depressing. I think that's as far as the depressing part of this podcast goes. Well, I suppose depending on how you view the scandal portion of this episode, but I've talked far too long, so let's get on with the music. The first track I've got for you is another play for Fairmont. This is It's All About You.
We are.
Fairmonts come from Clifton in New Jersey, and that track, It's All About You, comes off their last album, Destruction Creation. They do have kind of a very mellow indie pop sound, although that particular track is a bit more energetic than the typical Fairmont sound. I've played a few tracks of theirs in the past, off both this album and the last one. And yeah, good stuff. So, Doctor Who. I understand that we've actually got ahead of America now. So, I'm not sure whether to put the spoiler warnings on or not. I think I'm going to continue with the way I've been doing it and just not bother with the spoiler warnings, because the only two groups of people who I know listen to this show in America, one of them doesn't watch it at all and one has stopped watching, so I'm not going to put the spoiler warnings out, but I do give you fair warning that I will be spoiling these two last episodes, The Rebel Flesh and The Almost People. I think this story, these two episodes, will probably only really be remembered for the final scene. Very much like Utopia was in series 3, with the revelation that Derek Jacobi was actually the Master. I think I'm going to get to that in a moment, because I mean that is the big revelation that's going to affect the rest of the series. But before I really discuss that, I think it's only fair to evaluate the episodes themselves. This idea of gangers, you know, doppelgangers made of this flesh substance that can copy somebody perfectly, even down to their memories. That's an interesting idea. It's not a particularly original idea. It's been done a lot. I mean, not necessarily in Doctor Who, but it is a kind of trope that has become quite popular in sci-fi over the last 30 years or so. I mean, the obvious example is Blade Runner, where, you know, the eternal question is Deckard a replicant? And to be honest, I don't care enough about Blade Runner to really ask that question, but, you know, the idea that somebody can be artificial and yet still think they're human is an idea that's been around for a while and one that has been explored elsewhere. And to be honest, I think it's been explored better elsewhere. It seems almost perfunctory, the ethical considerations of the flesh and what they are and how the humans are treating them. It's a very surface examination of that concept. I mean, there are explanations for this. I mean, this is 2 hours split over 2 weeks for a supposedly kids audience. So the examination of this society and this new form of life, basically, I don't think it's done particularly well. It's very reminiscent of the comic book Surrogates that was made into a crappy film starring Bruce Willis. It's hard to get connected to the story because the writing, even though it wasn't done by Stephen Moffat, it was done by Matthew Graham, who wrote, or was one of the writers on Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes. So he has got some good history, but he also wrote the series 3 episode Fear Her, which was not the finest moment of Doctor Who. But he has got a good history. He is a good writer. But he seems to be rushing through the story to get to this big final revelation. I mean, even before the revelation, I thought the story was getting slightly short shrift. I mean, the bit where the gangers, who have been, until this point, determined to kill the humans, destroy the humans for mistreating them, they very quickly decide, we've had enough, we just want this to end. It was almost like a switch getting turned off, and that wasn't very satisfactory to me. But even before that, the way that Jennifer's story is told, the only ganger we have an extended interaction with, the way that story is told was very perfunctory. It was just ticking all the boxes of this type of story. Oh, I deserve to be alive too. I've got all the memories and all the emotions of my original. Why has this been done to me? And going a bit crazy, sticking eyes on the wall for some reason, which only seems to be in the story for a relatively interesting visual. It just seemed very workmanlike. I would have been interested in a proper full examination of this society and the way these gangers are treated in general, because at the end of the day, we only see how these particular 5 humans interact with their gangers. We don't get a rounded view of how the society treats gangers. For all we know, this could be an extreme case, but we're never really shown the full extent of this society, so it's almost like we're looking through a microscope at an elephant. I mean, we have no connection to this. It wasn't particularly well done. I mean, it was an enjoyable couple of episodes, but it could have been so much better. And the revelation at the end of episode 1, The Rebel Flesh, where the Doctor shows up in flesh form, that was pretty cool. And it was even cooler when, at the start of episode 2, he started doing catchphrases from previous Doctors, like, reverse the polarity of the neutron flow. During which I rather confused my family who was watching it with me by punching the air and shouting yes, but also offering a jelly baby. That was awesome. But that is another example of Stephen Moffat catering to the old fans and not really accounting for the younger fans. I mean, on his podcast, Lee from The Black Dog relates the story of how his 6-year-old daughter reacted to that scene, being very confused by it. And I'm sure that scene was repeated throughout the country. So it was cool, it was a nice little touch, but it's evidence of a wider problem that the story is getting more convoluted, more adult, and is less concerned with keeping up with the younger audience. One point that I really did like about the first episode was the way that Rory and Jennifer interacted. I think it was examining that trope of the new woman coming in and causing friction between a couple who've been together for a while. I mean, it was a little bit played out like that. Amy reacting to Jennifer like, oh, she's trying to steal my man. But I think it was a much subtler thing than that. And I think it is one of the few things that was subtle about this pair of episodes. And that is that we know that this Rory has some memories of being the Auton Centurion for 2 centuries looking after the Pandorica. How that happens is a mystery. I mean, it's, yeah, one of the problems that I had with the Big Bang, but I'm going to let that pass. I mean, in the story of Doctor Who, Rory has some of these memories of being the Auton Centurion that protects the Pandorica. So he, out of anybody in this cast, knows what it's like to be a plastic person, putting it in its most basic terms. So the fact that it's him who connects to this flesh Jennifer, I thought was very interesting. And he goes above and beyond the call of duty in helping and protecting Jennifer. Even when it becomes clear that she has nefarious purposes in mind. It was another case where, I mean, it was an interesting concept, but it wasn't really examined. The business with the two doctors, you know, one of them being Flash and one of them being our doctor, so to speak, was kind of interesting. I mean, yeah, all the time, who we think is our doctor was actually the Flesh Doctor. It's one of those things that in retrospect makes perfect sense. But it was a little bit confusing. It was a little bit too much business going on. You know, with throwing the sonic screwdriver around. I mean, I didn't spot this, but several people have posited the theory that there were actually 3 doctors during this episode because of some continuity issues with the sonic screwdriver. I haven't rewatched the episode to check this out, but I think I might have to. And if there are 3 doctors, then I think my initial thought when I saw the end of episode 1, that, oh, that's the doctor we saw get killed in The Impossible Astronauts. I still think that's what's going to happen. And I don't think that will be very satisfying. But I think that is going to turn out to be the truth. I mean, because the last time there was a quote-unquote continuity error, it did get played out properly in the series 5 episodes. Flesh and Stone, where 1 minute the Doctor's got a jacket on and the next minute he hasn't. That was properly explained. So I'm sure that this supposed 3rd Doctor does exist. I mean, because I trust the people who've said there was continuity errors. And I suspect that the 3rd Doctor is the one who got killed in The Impossible Astronauts. And so we come to the big reveal that Amy is Flesh. At the start of the story, there was a throwaway line that the Doctor has encountered the Flesh before, and he deliberately tried to get Amy and Rory to go somewhere else. So it's clear that he's known that Amy is Flesh for sometime. But the revelation when it came was shocking, and it made a lot of sense. It was almost as shocking an ending as the end of Day of the Moon, where the little girl suddenly starts regenerating, or apparently regenerating. But I think the fact that we've just spent 2 episodes learning that these flesh are, to all intents and purposes, humans. And then the Doctor just evaporates the flesh Amy with apparently very little thought. So, I mean, that was a little brutal. But to make that big gesture did bring the visual story to a thrilling climax. I mean, I think emotionally it was a bit wrong, but visually and in a storytelling standpoint, I think it worked perfectly. And I suppose the next question is, how long has Amy been Flash? When did the switch happen? When I saw the Doctor Who Confidential that was shown immediately after this, I personally got the impression that Amy has been Flash for the whole season. Because let's not forget, at the start of this season, Amy and Rory are just living together away from the Doctor. So I think the implication is that the switch happens sometime before that sequence where Amy and Rory are living together away from the Doctor. So we've been looking at the wrong Amy for the whole series. And of course this explains the eyepatch lady, who is keeping the real Amy healthy, I suppose, in order for her to give birth. And of course that also explains the facts why Amy is both pregnant and not pregnant at the same time. And it kind of explains how Amy apparently gives birth to this Time Lord child. Because the implication from the first two parts was that the regenerating little girl is Amy's daughter. So, a lot of threads seem to be coming together. But this does leave the question, why has this been done to Amy? Why is she pregnant with, apparently, a Time Lord? I mean, I don't think there's any way that the Doctor ever had sex with Amy. I mean, when it gets offered that openly in Series 5, at the end of Time of the Angels, and it gets rejected, I mean, there's no way that Amy and the Doctor ever shagged. But somebody, or somehow, Amy's been having some sweet, sweet Time Lord love. And the question is how and why? And who is the eye patch lady? What's going on? The mid-season finale, so to speak, is next week. Well, it's actually today as this is released. So hopefully a lot of these questions will be answered. And as I keep repeating, these answers better be satisfactory, otherwise I'm going to be very, very annoyed. But I still have faith in Stephen Moffat. I still think this is going to be brought together in a relatively satisfactory way. And I just hope I'm not proved wrong. So, in conclusion, I'm going to do my usual thing of grading these episodes. I think they were decent enough, could have been a lot better, and are basically only building up to this big revelation at the end with the fact that Amy is Flash. So I give the Rebel Flash a C-, and the Almost People a C+. Okay, next bit of music. And it's a first play on the show for No Age, who are a duo who come from Los Angeles. They're on the excellent record label Sub Pop. And this is a track that comes off their last released album, Everything in Between. I first came across this track when I was looking for music videos, and the video to this is rather cool. It's just the two band members in a furnished room, and the camera gradually zooms in on them. But the way it's done, it makes it look like the edges of the video frame are real, and it starts sort of crushing everything together, and eventually the two band members are huddling under a table, and then it comes out again and moves back in, and everything starts getting chopped up by the edges of the camera frame. It's quite cleverly done and quite effective, and it kind of fits the song, which is a very punky, very angry kind of sound, which I know some people aren't going to like, but who cares? I like it. It's a good video. It's a good track. And if I like it, I play it. So from Los Angeles, this is No Age with their track Fever Dreaming.
I guess you guys aren't ready for that yet. But your kids are gonna love it.
red lipstick man. Get your boyfriend out here and see you pout. Don't shower no more, taking his shirt outside. When your agent's calling, they shout my name just like you do every morning.
That was Fistful of Dollars by Bang Bang Etche, who come from Christchurch in New Zealand, and I last played them at the end of 2009. But that track comes off their last EP entitled Sonic Death Cunt. Yeah, a little bit of advice, Bang Bang Etche, being that's explicit in your EP titles is not big and it's not clever, but it's still a good track, so yeah, brought it to you on this episode. Okay, one of the bigger news stories over the last couple of months in the UK has been the controversy over so-called super injunctions and how easy they are to enforce and how they should be enforced. But I want to focus on the biggest one of these cases and the one that's gained the most publicity. And that's the case of Ryan Giggs. Now, I suppose I better start at the beginning. A couple of months ago, I think it was at the beginning of April, the Sun newspaper published a list of the stories that it couldn't report because injunctions had been taken out against them. Obviously, all the details of the people involved had been taken out. But this started the debate. I mean, there was a lot of people on there, a lot of cases on there, which the newspaper said it was not able to publish because the courts had prevented them from publishing these names. And one of these was a footballer who went by the name CTB in court documents. And he had taken out this injunction against the Sun newspaper and its parent company News Group Now, at the time, nobody knew who this footballer was, who had been having an affair with a woman named Imogen Thomas. Basically, her only claims to fame was that she was on Big Brother a couple of years ago. So, bit of a non-celebrity there. But allegedly, she'd been having an affair with a Premiership footballer, and the Premiership footballer had taken out this injunction against News Group and The Sun to prevent his name getting published. Well, then a Twitter account popped up and claimed to have details about who all these people were, who The Sun were talking about. And it revealed that CCB was Ryan Giggs, who had been apparently having an affair with Imogen Thomas. And this spread all over Twitter. I mean, it was the biggest open secret in Britain that Ryan Giggs had been having an affair, and he had taken out an injunction against The Sun. Now, I knew this was going on, but to be honest, I really didn't care enough to find out which footballer had been having his end away. So I never went online and find out who it was. But then Ryan Giggs did something rather foolish. He took legal action against Twitter to try and make them give out the names of everybody who had been spreading his name along the internet. Now, of course, this only made things worse, because it kicks off what is known as the Streisand effect, where as soon as a celebrity tries to cover something up, it spreads around the internet like wildfire. So basically, he made things a hell of a lot worse for himself by trying to take this action against Twitter. I mean, even thinking that it would do any good is just a really foolish idea. And on the back of this legal action and his name becoming so widely spread around the internet, the Sunday Herald, which is a newspaper in Scotland, decided that it was going to publish his name. Because according to them, this injunction that had been taken out in England did not apply in Scotland. And they have a legal argument for this. I mean, there is a different legal code in Scotland. Prompted by the fact that Ryan Giggs' name had been published in Scotland, a Liberal Democrat MP named John Hemming used parliamentary privilege to announce in Parliament and ask a question in Parliament that Ryan Giggs was CTB. And this opened the floodgates, because despite the fact that the injunction was in place, newspapers can report on parliamentary questions. So because it had been talked about in Parliament, it could be now talked about in the papers. And Ryan Giggs' name was plastered over the front page of pretty much every newspaper, including the sort of respectable broadsheets, The Telegraph, The Guardian, The Independent. And I cannot stress enough how rare it is for those newspapers to have on their front page the fact that somebody in the public eye is having an affair. Now, in the ordinary run of events, the fact that Ryan Giggs was having an affair with Imogen Thomas would have been, I don't know, page 6 or 7 of The Sun or The Mirror, you know, a trashy tabloid. But because he had taken out this injunction and then tried to take legal action against Twitter, and Twitter had this massive backlash against Ryan Giggs. Supposedly, the day this happened, one in every 200 clicks on the internet was on this Twitter feed that named Ryan Giggs. Or rather, one in every 200 British clicks on the internet was on this Twitter feed. Once that had happened, it became a much bigger story. And if he had just bitten the bullet and had this go on page 7 of The Sun, it would have been forgotten by now. But instead, he's been spread all over all of the media, basically. He's made things 100 times worse, 1,000 times worse for himself. It's just ridiculous to think you can chain the internet, and probably more specifically Twitter. To think that you can control Twitter is ludicrous. We live in an age now of 24-hour news and information being published on a website in America or Canada or Australia or Brazil, and it being instantly available to everybody around the world. We have gone so far past the point where this kind of injunction against a British newspaper can have any real effect on whether a story gets reported and how it disseminates. The law is so far behind the times. I mean, I've talked in the past about the British libel laws, and while this is slightly different, the same kind of thing applies. The law as it stands at the moment is not fit for purpose. In a digital age, we need different laws, and we need to think about what this kind of super injunction does. I think there is a strong argument to say that the fact Ryan Giggs is having an affair with Imogen Thomas, or was having an affair with Imogen Thomas, is not newsworthy. I don't think you can claim that that fact is in the public interest. When I found out it was Ryan Giggs, I was disappointed in him. He is one of those footballers who is universally loved. I mean, he was the BBC Sports Personality of the Year 2 years ago. He's still playing at the age of 37, and he is the most decorated player in English football history, including 12 Premiership Champions medals. He is a loved figure, and the fact that he had an affair does make me think a little less of him, especially as he was having an affair with Imogen Thomas. I mean, you've got to criticise his taste, if nothing else. But again, I don't think it's in the public interest to know this. But I think there are cases out there where it is in the public interest to know. If a politician who prides himself on his family values has an affair, then I think that is in the public interest because it exposes hypocrisy. I mean, when this all flared up, the British political journalist Andrew Marr, who again is a pretty beloved figure, admitted that he's taken out an injunction in 2008 after he had an affair with a female journalist. And again, I think that fact is in the public interest because Andrew Marr is the kind of person who asks the politicians whether they are morally correct. So again, it exposes the hypocrisy. So there are cases where this kind of information needs to be disseminated. Unfortunately, the modern tabloid journalism I would say sort of like 90% of these exposés of people who've been having affairs are not in the public interest. But you have to take the good with the bad. This kind of injunction, we are not allowed to say that you have had an injunction against you. We've gone too far. I don't think there's any moral or ethical reason why people shouldn't know these things. I mean, there are questions of privacy, and I mean, in the instance of Ryan Giggs, I think there's a strong argument for his privacy being protected. But if we want to expose the hypocrites, we're going to have to live with the fact that people who don't have that level of hypocrisy are also going to be caught up in this. We can't have one rule for one and another rule for somebody else. If we want to expose the hypocrites, we're going to have to take some quote-unquote innocence down with us. I do feel sorry for Ryan Giggs. The fact that he tried to silence the internet does make me wonder about his sanity and maybe his intelligence. But he did have an affair. People thought that it was worth reporting. And by trying to silence it, he's made it 100 times worse for himself. And while there's a strong argument for Ryan Giggs' privacy being protected, I think the bigger issue and the bigger question is the fact that newspapers should be allowed to report when people are being hypocrites. Yeah, I think that's pretty much all I've got to say on that, so let's get on to the next bit of music. And here's a band I first came across when Dave played them on The Inside Outcast. They come from the East Midlands of the UK, and they're called To Bury a Ghost. This track comes off their EP The Hurt Kingdom, which is available for free download from their Bandcamp site. And it's got a very strong Muse feel to it. I think this could almost be Matt Bellamy singing. But I suppose, as they say, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So if you want to sound like a band, I think Muse is one of the better ones you could imitate. But it's still a good track in its own right, and I really like it. So here is To Bury a Ghost with their track Coming Up for Air.
Britain, 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 the other name for the UK. Britain invented music in the 1960s, but other countries keep trying to steal it. Made in the UK show is a podcast put together by podcasters in the UK. It brings you the cream of British music, a little like an internet milkman. Listen to British music at madeintheukshow.co.uk. British music, are you getting enough?
And that's returns the show for Fur, who come from Detroit with their track I Want to Let You Down. And you may remember that Fur is the band whose track Pretty Thoughts is still currently my favourite track I've played on the podcast this year. Really nice gothic industrial type band. And that track, I Want to Let You Down, is also utterly awesome and comes off their last EP, Devastates the Details, which you can download for free from their website, which is furnoise.com. And last time I checked, they've got two EPs up there for free download, and I highly recommend you go and download both of them because they are brilliant. So, it's time for another announcement regarding Weekly Music Video Podcast. I have been contemplating over the last few weeks the idea that I was going to do a large format HD version of WMVP. Well, I've decided to do it. I was doing the last episode of WMVP, which was the video for The Emancipation by Trisil. I was doing the usual thing of having the iPod format, which is what I've always done, and I was testing out the technology to do the HD iPad format version of the video as well. And I was watching the large format video, and it was so clear that the HD video that I was using in the episode came through so beautifully in the large format video that I decided that I just had to do the large format show. So from now on, there will be two versions of WMVP that I'm going to release. The regular version is going to be the standard 640 by 480 resolution. And I'm also going to release an HD 1280 by 720 version as well. It's soon going to be on iTunes. I've already set up a Feedburner feed if you want to do that now. It's feeds.feedburner.com/WMVP_HD. That's going to get you subscribed to the large format episodes, if that's your preferred content, if you've got an iPad or other tablet device. Actually, thinking about it, I haven't actually tested it out on my tablet yet, but it's been having internet connection issues, so try that soon. So yeah, if you like your music videos in large format HD, then they are now available to you.
Weird Trash of the Week.
Last weekend, I was lucky enough that two of my oldest friends, Dan and Tim, were in town on the same day. They both live various places in the country, and coincidentally, they were both in town last Saturday, so we all met up and had a lovely afternoon drinking in a riverside pub. And at that time, I gave Tim fair warning that he would absolutely hate this week's Weird Track of the Week. He is quite a middle-of-the-road person when it comes to musical taste, God love him. I think his favourite album is probably ABBA Gold, and he has been vocal in the past about his dislike of some of the industrial music I play. Well, this week's Weird Track of the Week is going to be a bit harsh to his delicate ears, because it's by Polluted Axis, who comes from Las Vegas, Nevada, and he is signed to the record label Crunch Pod, which specializes in the aggressive, harsh agrotech end of the industrial spectrum. Very heavy music, very fast music. It's kind of at the drum and bass end of the industrial spectrum, if you like. And this track is no exception. It comes off Pellucid Axis' last EP called The Ruin Nation, which was kind of a remix EP for his first release, The Trepanation Nation. He seems to have this thing about trepanation. I mean, he made it the theme of his first EP. And this track is called Oopsie Lobotomy. Now, for those of you who don't know, trepanation is the practice of drilling a hole in a living person's skull to relieve the pressure on the brain. I mean, it's one of the oldest forms of surgery there is. I mean, there's been Stone Age people, skeletons have been discovered. But it also became rather popular in the counterculture of the 60s, because supposedly, if you drill a hole in somebody's brain and interfere with the blood-brain barrier, then you open the doors of perception and all this kind of stuff. So all these hippies ended up drilling holes in their skulls. Well, this is the theme of the first two EPs by Pellucid Axis. Yeah, rather strange, and rather strange music, but I like it, even though Tim will probably hate it, and I'm guessing a good proportion of my listeners will also hate it as well. So, from Las Vegas, Nevada, this is Pellucid Axis with Oopsie Lobotomy. See you next time, and remember, good music is infinite.
You have been listening to Colin and the Ouroboros podcast. Good music is infinite.